At first glance, it was like any other New York morning. But it was to be a morning remembered for years to come. At 8:30 a.m., the usual commuters were traveling to work by subway or on foot. Thousands took the elevators up the World Trade Center towers. 2,000 of them would never come down alive. A catastrophic collision was about to take place. Wars were to be waged. Civilian lives were to be lost. But this was a game that had started years ago. It had taken decades for the main players to become who they were now, who the tragedy needed them to be. But now, the long, painful prelude was over. It was a warm, sunny day. The sky almost clear. A perfect stage for the grand crescendo. This was by no means a conspiracy. It was a long, sad tragedy coming to a late, fearsome finale. The Empire was to pay a price for all the fears. At 0 hour, all hell broke loose.
They both served in the Ford administration in the mid-70s. Ford came to power after Nixon left office. Rumsfeld was the elder of the two, and he appointed Cheney, who was then only 33, I think, as his assistant in the White House. And the two of them were very close in the Ford administration. They were known to stay friends when they both left office. They both served subsequently in government and maintained contact out of government. And then they were brought together again in the administration of George W. Bush.
Back in the good old days, Cheney and his friend took part in some unusual activities, which would come extremely handy in the days after 9/11.
In 1976, President Ford appointed an outside commission, which was referred to as Team B, to basically challenge the CIA's intelligence on Soviet missiles. We'll have them look over the same intelligence as the CIA and see whether they come to the same results or not. Rather than looking at the known facts at hand and drawing conclusions on that basis, they kind of inverted the analytical process and they said, okay, well, we'll start with the hypothesis that the Soviet Union has all of these missiles that we're saying that it has, and we'll just kind of look for evidence to support that intelligence analysis.
They were worried that America was spending less and less on defense, on military, and its rivals were getting stronger and stronger. Donald Rumsfeld even used to carry around a little booklet about Pearl Harbor, about how the proportion of the GDP that America was spending now on defense was less than it was prior to Pearl Harbor.
But ultimately, in the long term, Team B was wrong because they actually predicted that the Soviet Union was still very strong, that it would continue as a major threat. But just 15 years after the Team B report, of course, the Soviet Union collapsed. This was a precedent for what happened before the Iraq War, that they saw that you could successfully challenge the CIA on political grounds and attack it from the right and discredit the CIA's findings.
Were any of those people in the Team B, were any of them famous? Do we know any of them?
We know Paul Wolfowitz. Paul Wolfowitz was a member of Team B, and I think it's clear that he also learned some lessons from that about how you could challenge the CIA on political grounds. And in particular, I think what he and Cheney and Rumsfeld took from it was the style of intelligence analysis that Team B used.
25 years later, Wolfowitz too was in the administration. But before that, he put his signature on a controversial report, a report later used by 9/11 conspiracy theorists.
It was a report written about US defense posture and future US defense posture. And it was really written to try to influence the debate in the 2000 election. So it was produced by PNAC, and a number of future members of the Bush administration contributed to the study sessions that produced the report, including Paul Wolfowitz, I think Stephen Cambone, and I think 10 others who went on to serve in the Bush administration.
That was really the Bush think tank. You know, we had Dick Cheney, Richard Armitage, John Bolton, all of the key players in the current administration were part of this think tank. They had written already about going into Iraq several years ago. So 9/11 provided them with the trigger that they needed to do this.
It's like, I'm not set getting into the whole conspiracy thing about whether the United States knew it was going to happen. I'm not interested in that. What I can say for sure is that the United States needed a 9/11 event in order to bounce the American public into another war. And they've used it very skillfully to try and create war hysteria inside the United States.
On 9/11 itself, just I think about 5 hours after the attacks, we know that Donald Rumsfeld told some of his aides that he wanted the best information as quickly as possible to see whether this could be linked to Saddam Hussein, whether they could go beyond Osama bin Laden, and the actual words that he used were go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not.
You could already see that at the time, not so much Bush, but the people below him, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, using this to their advantage and using it to take the project much further in the sense of not simply hitting back at Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, but using it to hit back at other American enemies. And of course, topping the list at that time was Iraq, even though there were others within the White House, others within the administration that were somewhat incredulous.
After 9/11, the project for the new American century didn't hang around. They hijacked the terrorist attacks to win support for their own political agenda. In a letter to President Bush, the group would help shape US foreign policy for years to come.
And the first thing they said was, obviously, Osama bin Laden has to be captured and killed. But then they also went on to say that any effort to combat terrorism would not be successful if it did not try to change the regime in Iraq. And I think another thing that's very, very important about that letter is that at no stage did it mention this idea of democratization. This letter was designed as the bare minimum if the US is to win the war on terror, and at no point did it include this concept of democratization.
It was not the first time that the PNAC had sent an open letter to an American president. Years before, after Bill Clinton had been elected for a second term, defeating Republican candidate Bob Dole, the project for the new American century was born.
And the regret was that after the so-called first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein, that they didn't carry on, get rid of him, and establish a proper democratic state.
Unlike in the past, the foreign policy theorists of the neoconservatives in the post-9/11 period became well known by the American people. But to delve into their roots, we must return to the Cold War.
There were really two generations of neoconservatives. The first generation, the older Cold War generation, and then the post-Cold War generation. The first generation advocated what was essentially a defensive policy, primarily vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. They basically advocated containment, but it was a very aggressive form of containment.
The Americans had tended to see wars as crusades against evils. But now we were in a world where, although communism was seen by the vast majority of Americans as an evil, perhaps an evil to be destroyed,
it also defined itself in opposition to the realism of the Nixon-Kissinger administration. They said that the policies of Nixon and Kissinger had no moral content whatsoever, that the US should remember why it was fighting the Cold War, that it was fighting this godless ideology of communism, you know, this totalitarian ideology. And here was Nixon going to Moscow, making agreements with these totalitarians.
But then something happened in a small country in Latin America. And out of it, a moral paradox arose that was to recur again and again and haunt the neocons as their fortunes rose and fell in American politics.
Well, the problem was that for the Americans, the coming to power of the party in Chile was something extremely dangerous, because they saw this as possibility of a new way in which very leftist parties would actually come to power. And Allende, Salvador Allende in Chile, was seen, even though he was moderately left-wing by many standards, he was seen as a danger. And even though he came to power democratically, the United States believed that his own interest and the interest of the region demanded that aid be given to those who sought to overthrow the Allende regime.
In 1970, in Chile, an election was held. The result was a win for the communists. The CIA cooperated in a bloody coup which successfully overthrew the government.
Well, actually, that military coup, which took place on September the 11th, it was the first 9/11, actually more people died immediately as a result of the coup than died in 9/11 in 2001.
They undermined the Allende government from the very beginning. Allende was elected in 1970. All through the period that he was in office, despite all the shortages because of the US blockade, because of the economic war against Chile by the United States, support for popular unity increased. And so Kissinger, Henry Kissinger, then promoted the coup against Allende, in which Pinochet became the president of Chile.
The Chilean army made a coup which overthrew Mr. Allende and brought to power Mr. Pinochet. The United States government was surprised by the coup.
Well, I think that's just a total joke. I'd find it very difficult to believe that he's that stupid. Therefore, I must believe he's just telling you a lie. There's so much evidence for the US involvement in the preparations of the military coup.
But it didn't stop in Chile. There was a thing called Operation Condor, which was a US-inspired campaign against the left in Chile, Argentina, Paraguay, Bolivia and Peru. And 25,000 people died or disappeared during that Operation Condor.
The neocons didn't feel comfortable. US support for a dictator was indefensible, but the policymakers would find ways to justify their actions. The neocons, who had set out to form a more ethical foreign policy, had failed. And it was a failure that would haunt them forever.
Well, I think the key argument was put forward in an article by Jean Kirkpatrick, and the article was published in 1979, a very famous article. It was called Dictatorships and Double Standards, and it was published in Commentary magazine. And Kirkpatrick, in that article, basically said, the world is bipolar. You have the United States and its democratic allies and the non-communist world. And then on the other side, you have the Soviet Union and its proxies in the rest of the world. And Kirkpatrick said, the Soviet Union is a mortal threat directly to the United States. So she said, sometimes, if we're going to counter that threat, we will need to ally ourselves with undemocratic regimes.
In the Cold War, we were fighting against the Soviet Union because we really believed that the Soviet Union was going to invade. This was what we were told.
It is true that the Soviet army was quite strong, so of course was our army. But they always used to say, you must judge the Soviets by their capabilities, not their intentions. But you judge the West by their intentions, not their capabilities. It was paranoia. But every war is paranoia.
A bipolar world was all the US foreign policy community wanted to see. And when one of the poles collapsed in the late 1980s, that community faced a crisis. The crisis of who to fight.
When the Cold War ended, That group of neoconservatives, which included people like Jean Kirkpatrick, Norman Podderitz, Irving Kristol, they actually advocated that America should take a step back from the rest of the world.
But it was too late for America to turn back now. The United States had pushed for its interests in so much of the world that it simply couldn't give it all up.
When the Soviet Union collapsed, we had a new situation. And this is why you saw immediately after the Cold War, they rushed into the Gulf War, they rushed into the Balkan part. Although we had now a free hand to do really very much what we liked in the world, there was a problem. Is that we no longer had the justification. The Soviet Union was gone, so why would we be going into these countries?
A second generation of neocons arose from this frustration. Now the delicate task of justifying US hegemony rested on the shoulders of the younger neocons.
This was led by a now quite famous neoconservative called Charles Krauthammer. And Krauthammer wrote a very famous article in 1991 called The Unipolar Moment. And Krauthammer's idea was that during the Cold War, the world had been bipolar because you'd had these two competing superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States. But he said that now that the Soviet Union had collapsed, the world was no longer bipolar, it wasn't even multipolar, it was unipolar. And he said the objective now of US foreign policy should be to preserve and extend the unipolar moment for as far into the future as possible. Now, this was picked up on by members of the then Bush administration, that's the first Bush administration. Dick Cheney, who was then Secretary of Defense, was charged with reviewing defense posture in the light of the end of the Cold War. And he got his assistant, Paul Wolfowitz, to write a report about what America's new defense posture should be in the post-Cold War world.
Before George H.W. Bush left power, Wolfowitz wrote a defense policy guidance document, which, if you like, put on print in print and on paper the whole idea that the end of the Cold War was a great opportunity for America to try to do anything in American power to prevent rivals emerging.
Now, Wolfowitz was working with a guy called Lewis Libby, another neoconservative who also went on to work for the second Bush administration. And they were also working with an Afghan-American called Zalmay Khalilzad, who also went on to work for the second Bush administration. And together, they wrote this document called the Defense Planning Guidance, which was really the seminal strategy document of the neoconservative movement in the post-Cold War years. I think the importance that he attached to it is indicated by the fact that even after George H.W. Bush lost the election in 1992, Cheney nevertheless signed off on that document before he left office, even though he knew that he himself would be leaving office and that the incoming Clinton administration would reject that document. He still signed it anyway, and I think that indicates the importance that he attached to it, really.
This is perhaps the most important concept in the neocon worldview.
So they would look at, for example, in the late 90s, they looked at what was happening in the Balkans, in Kosovo, and the question that the neocons would ask would be, does this affect our unipolar position? Therefore, if we're going to protect our position as the unipolar power, we have to take action here in this instance.
That means that when the Americans go into Iraq, they go into Iraq not to annex the country, not even, believe it or not, at least from the standpoint of the U.S. government, just to take it over as an economic unit. They go over there to show they're the most powerful country in the world.
I do think, you know, that at its most fundamental, the basic point of going into Iraq was to show the world who was boss.
Because the purpose of the Iraq War in 2003 was to demonstrate that America was all-powerful. That's the point of it. It wasn't just for the oil. It wasn't just for weapons of mass destruction. It definitely wasn't for that. It was just to demonstrate that there is no power. And that's been the shift. If there is a shift that you wish to take this further, it is that the Bush administration in the United States, unlike any previous administration, its goal was power for its own sake. Its goal was to acquire what they call a preponderance of power over others.
And obviously, if you're going to be a unipolar power in the world at large, you have to be the dominant power in the Middle East. And that is why they went into Iraq. There is certainly, the second generation certainly invoke a moral and ethical overlay to what they do. And there's also there's this common perception that neoconservatism in the 1990s and in the early 2000s is ideologically determined, and there's this idea that it's about exporting democracy. So in reality, for a neoconservative, if they're arguing that America should be using military force, it won't be to export democracy. It will actually be to protect strategic interests that are integral to the maintenance of the unipolar moment.
Back in the future, Republicans lost the elections to a young, revitalized Democrat Party. Bad news for the neocons. But by signing the Defense Policy Guidance document, Cheney was to leave his mark on the future.
I think the neocons went further than that, though, because preponderance of power usually describes a level of dominance that would not quite amount to unipolarity. So I think unipolar would be the best way to describe what the neocons wanted.
In 1994, the neocons were for the first time successful in their attempts to shape their unipolar world, bringing back memories of the administration of President Ford.
Neoconservatives felt that Clinton wasn't going far enough. They wanted him to just completely abrogate from the anti-ballistic missile treaty and go ahead and research and deploy full national missile defense. So many of them testified to Congress about the importance of national missile defense. And Frank Gaffney's organization, the Center for Security Policy, worked in tandem with its allies in Congress on the congressional committees in order to force a review, an outside review, along the lines of Team B, of the CIA's intelligence on ballistic missile threats from so-called rogue states. At that time, the CIA was saying, well, there is no viable ballistic missile threat from a rogue state. The neoconservatives realized, well, we have to challenge the CIA. So instead of doing what the CIA did and looking at what we knew already about ballistic missile threats, they started with their hypothesis that there was, in fact, a ballistic missile threat to the US. And then they looked for evidence that might support that. And they came up with a conclusion that there would be a ballistic missile threat to the United States in 5 years from both Iran and North Korea. This was in 1998. I think you view what happened in 2003 with the so-called intelligence failure in a different light if you know what happened in 1976 and 1998 with the Rumsfeld Commission.
Plan B was relaunched, and this time it was also successful. Rumsfeld and his group got away with their unusual hypothesis-based method. In the build-up to the war in Iraq, the failure of the American media and legislature to identify and stop the practice of hypothesis-based analysis turned out to be the most costly mistake America had ever made.
Some of those people who were involved in the Rumsfeld Commission were also involved in the Team B exercise in the 1970s. So I think there are clear precedents there. They'd very much learnt from the Team B episode and they knew what they were doing.
The project for the New American Century, the neocon think tank responsible for the controversial Pearl Harbor document, became famous for a similar document in 1998. A public letter to President Clinton regarding a country in the Middle East. It had no links with Al-Qaeda or the 9/11 attacks, but it was rich in oil, and it had perplexed the neocons for years.
Of course, there were all sorts of problems with the inspections at this stage, and the Project for the New American Century said, we can't let Saddam keep thumbing his nose at the United States. This letter was signed by many signatories who would go on to serve in the administration of George Bush in 2001. Among them were people like Richard Pearl, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and of course Robert Kagan and William Kristol, who were really the architects of this policy at the time. They were the most vocal proponents, two of the most vocal proponents of regime change in Iraq.
The way the neocons saw it, for America to perpetuate its unipolar vision as far as possible, it was necessary to stamp out all signs of disobedience.
There were hints that they wanted to pursue this line in 1996 because of the failed CIA-led coups in Iraq. And Paul Wolfowitz was the first to come out and say, this covert approach that we're taking just isn't working. You know, we can't sit back idly with our containment policy and let Saddam get out of his box. That was the way that he phrased it. And he was one of the first people to say we need to go beyond containment. But it was then in late 1997, as a result of what was going on with the inspections, that the Weekly Standard and the Project for the New American Century first came out and said, right, we need regime change in Iraq. And this resulted in Clinton passing the Iraq Liberation Act in November 1998, which said that it was actually very much based on the Chalabi plan, because it said that it was now the official policy of the United States to work towards regime change in Iraq by supporting Iraqi opposition groups, principally the Iraqi National Congress. And in actual fact, many of them were quite disappointed with the results of the Iraq Liberation Act, firstly because Clinton wasn't really implementing it, because he wasn't really giving funds to the opposition.
By the late 1990s, the neocons, along with old hawks like Rumsfeld and Cheney, had gotten to know each other. They got along rather well, but that still wasn't enough for the grand tragedy. There was a third player that had not yet joined them. The third player was getting ready to enter the stage from a universe far away from Capitol Hill.